everything.
Okay, folks, we are.
Give me a final average salary of $300,000.
Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. I want to welcome to the Senate Workforce Committee. Today is Monday, February 15th, 2017. I hope everybody had a good Valentine's Day yesterday. I'm going to go ahead and open an informational hearing on the Oregon Public Employee Retirement System. This is our fourth informational hearing in the committee's conversation about PERS. So far, we've heard about the history of the program, its structure and financial status, key Supreme Court rulings concerning PERS, and some of the current legislative issues. Today's informational meeting will have two parts. First, we'll hear three presentations by experts on PERS financing and investment management. And second, we'll hear from Senator Canope about some of the ideas that emerged from a PERS work group that he formed with Senator Johnson over the interim session. So hopefully Senator Johnson will be able to be here. You may recall that PERS Director Steve Rodman explained that the long-term sustainability, the state's retirement system is based on balancing the equation. That equation is benefits equals our contributions and earnings equals benefits. That equation is shorthand for balancing the present value of earned employee benefits with employer funds to pay pension benefit and future returns on invested funds. For the first part of today's informational meeting, we will focus on the earnings component of the equation, specifically how the state manages the financing investment to pay for PERS benefits. We'll hear presentations by three experts who are here today. Laura Lockwood McCall, the Director of Debt Management from the Oregon State Treasury, John Shervam, the Chief Investment Officer from the Oregon State Treasury, and Steve Rodman, Executive Director of PERS. We're going to go ahead and get started, and I will call Laura Lockwood McCall, again, Director of Debt Management of the Oregon State Treasury. Come forward.
That's not my presentation, though.
Yes. Well, Debbie will. The brains behind the operation, Debbie Malone, right here.
Well, this is getting ready. Thank you for inviting me. My name
is Laura. Thank you for coming.
Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the director of the Debt Management Division. So my involvement in intersection with PERS are a couple-fold, but I'm not directly responsible either for investments or for managing the system. But I oversee the state's bond issues. And so here's the reasons why I'm involved with PERS, because every time we do credit ratings for the state, we obviously talk about PERS, both the unfunded liabilities of the system and where we stand. And so I thought I'd have a few remarks about that. But also, several years ago, the state sold pension obligation bonds to help fund PERS. So just recognizing the two people who are really the experts in what you said will be coming behind me. So I'll go really quickly, okay, unless you ask me otherwise. I wasn't 100% sure what you were looking for this today, so forgive me if I talk about things you're not all that interested in.
Okay, well, before you get started, so thank you for that. I wanted to acknowledge that we have Senator Johnson here. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for your courtesy and letting me sit
in. Just, you know, we were talking behind your back when you came in. Your ears were probably burning. And the only good things. And first we're going to hear about the experts about basically talking about refinancing PERS debt.
And you've got the experts sitting right there.
And then the second half of today's hearing will be Senator Canope is going to go over three ideas that came from the work group that the two of you had in the interim.
Perfect.
So just wanted you to know that your name was mentioned prior to arriving. So.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Great. Go ahead. And so, we're going to be happy with what we just wanted to understand, because people do refer to your office and talking about refinancing, what's happened. You know, I know you have a presentation ready to go. So if you need to stray from the presentation in order to address, we're trying to talk about the pluses and minuses to any kind of refinancing of the debt. So.
And that's great. And so to that end, because most of you I had never seen in presentations that I've done, I sort of did a quickie, just a few pages of Bonding 101. So I apologize again if that's not your true interest. But real quickly, the state sells lots of different kinds of bonds for lots of different things. It's just a bond is simply a way, package of IOUs in a big contractual form where investors provide us money and we have a legal obligation to repay the debt. In its most basic form, we have debt service schedules which have principal and interest, just like if you have a mortgage or a car loan. And I know that sounds a little simple because it's pretty complicated to do, but that's the big picture. It's the main source of funding for most of the state's major capital infrastructure and capital project development throughout the state. The interest is generally considered tax exempt, which means it's not subject to either federal or state taxes, and that gets us a much better interest rate than if we had to sell bonds on a taxable basis. Mm-hmm. However, the pension obligation bonds that were sold in 2003 are not considered governmental purpose under federal law, so you should understand that those bonds were sold at higher interest rates and they were federally taxable, and that's true whether it was state of Oregon bonds or school districts' pension obligation bonds. So when people are comparing whatever our PERS unfunded liability rates might be versus bonding, then the gap between those is a taxable interest rate that we could achieve versus whatever the assumed earnings rate is. Okay? And again, I won't go into it, but there's a huge variety of things that we use the state's debt capacity for every year in the bonding bill. And that can include a lot of state office buildings. It includes highways, roads, public universities, community colleges. We also have a lot of different programs for local government, including our new program for matching grants for public schools. But there's also programs to do seismic upgrades. And, of course, we're starting to spend some bonding authority on low-income multifamily housing. So when we talk about possibilities of issuing new pension obligation bonds, the backdrop is the trade-offs between should we use our bonding capacity for reducing our PERS liability versus a lot of the infrastructure and capital projects needs around the state. There's a fairly sophisticated process for us to do the debt capacity analysis. We deliver a report through the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission each year to all the members of the legislature. Just real quickly, we use the long-term revenue forecast embedded in OEA's quarterly revenue forecast. There's a big back section that has what the revenue forecast will look like for the next 10 years. We have a database that tracks all existing debt. We make assumptions about future debt through the bond bill. And our goal is to have a steady state where old debt is coming off the books and new debt is available to come on the books, with the goal of keeping our annual debt service at no more than 5% of general fund revenues for general fund supported debt.
Madam Chair.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Are you all the repository as well for any tracking information on the issuance of revenue bonds?
Through the chair, Senator Johnson, my office tracks all local and state GO bonds, revenue bonds, conduit revenue bonds. So, yes, I can get you data on anything that's a bond related through
the. I don't want the data. The data. I just want to make sure somebody's paying attention.
Yes, one of our statutes is through the Treasurer's Office is the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. And I staff that committee, and we get information every time anybody wants to sell bonds. So, yes, I could point a finger, boom, and tell you about annual debt service.
I'll sleep
guarantees
tonight.
Is that. Thanks. Yes, thank you. And the legislature was smart enough to fund that for updated software for that program a few years ago. The bottom line, though, is that the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission sets some targets for keeping debt service at a reasonable, prudent level. And it's no magic, but it's been the sort of our standard to keep it, as I said, approximately 5% of general fund revenues. And that will come in important as we talk about debt capacity for POBs and trade-offs, as I said. There's a variety of legal authorities in the Constitution. We're not allowed to borrow general obligation bonds for more than $50,000 unless there's a carve-out in the Constitution to allow that. And so you may hear about Article 11F or G or P or O. And what that really means is their voter approval for specific carve-outs to allow us to sell general obligation bonds. And there's debt limits for each of those. Now, in the case of the pension obligation bonds, it was approved by the voters in the early 2000s. The state sold roughly $2 billion in pension obligation bonds to fund earlier unfunded liabilities of the system. And the debt limit is 1% of the real market value of property in the state. So we still have approximately $1.7 billion of that $2 billion that was sold 13 years ago outstanding. So if folks were interested in how much capacity we would have, it's really the difference between the $5 billion and the $1.7 billion, which is about a little over $3 billion.
Because you're a recognized expert, could you comment on the timing issues of the sale of these bonds with respect to whether or not they have actually been part of solving a problem versus, frankly, just the accumulation of additional debt and the possibility that it exacerbated it?
I was not, through the chair, I was not working for the state at the time the bonds were sold in 2003. I came to the state in 2004. It's my understanding at the time the decision was made against a backdrop of five special sessions of the legislature with massive PERS reforms at the time to go ahead and to sell these bonds because the assumed rate at the time was 8%. The bonds were sold at 5.75%. So the theoretical savings was that 2.25%. Now, you don't really know whether that was a good idea or a bad idea because you also have to take into consideration what do you earn on the proceeds. What happens is that the bond proceeds are placed into a site account, and that was the state sold POBs, and we sold them in a GO form. There was 9 pool deals that were done by the School Board Association and I think another group for community colleges and schools. Depending on when you sold the bonds, you may have sold it when the market was low. You may have sold it when the overall stock market was high. And so that has to go into the consideration because PERS pulls money each year from that side account to offset part of the employer rates. If times are good and you earn a good rate of return, then that corpus, think of it as almost as an endowment, doesn't have to get depleted. And so you continue to have that money. So on a present value basis, it was a good move. But some of the school districts and the pools did not sell at the bottom of the capital markets. They sold at the peak. So they sold in 07 and or later. And so in the first few years, the market dropped. PERS, and Steve can tell you more about how they move money out of the side account. So if you draw a lot of money out of the side account in the early years, it's very hard to earn back up to the rate of return you needed to break even. So timing is absolutely essential as to whether it's a good or bad idea. And again, we can't really know. So it's a speculative decision. In addition to eating up a lot of debt capacity that could be used for infrastructure, it's also a fairly risky bet on future earnings.
I think you have just answered my question because there have been those that have pushed for the sale of more bonds in order to help alleviate some of the problem. And I think you have just put on the record the cautionary tale that timing, purpose, things unknowable to us, market conditions, are things that one would have to be very, very cautious about were we to head in this direction again.
Through the chair. I would say that's the case. Later in my presentation, the Government Finance Officers Association, which is the professional organization I belong to, it cautions against communities actually doing POBs because of the speculative nature of the transaction. It's not to say that people haven't done it. It's not to say that people consider it, but the state of Alaska was recently considering doing a new round of POB financing to move their unfunded liability from the 60-something percent to the 80, and basically they were put on credit watch and were told in no uncertain terms that they would be downgraded.
Okay.
And they withdrew the bond transaction. It was a $3 billion-ish bond issue. That happened within the last couple of months.
Thank you.
Okay.
Again, for those who weren't here, like I wasn't, the bonds that were sold in 2003, as I mentioned, the difference between at the time the assumed rate and the borrowing rate. Another thing that happened, and again, whether it was right or wrong, they delayed principal on repayment for many years. And so not only was it bonding out this liability, but they needed budget relief because of the severe budget crisis the state was under in 03, 04. So this picture shows you the amortization. The darker blue is the principal repayment, and you can see how there's very little principal repayment. And that's the reason why, even though it's been 13 years, we still have $1.7 billion of the $2 billion. So only about 15% of the principal has been repaid. Now, a lot of folks sold POBs with upward sloping amortization because they said, well, the PERS liability will be upward sloping, but it tends to then eat up a lot of debt capacity for a long time, as opposed to doing more level debt service, which is more typical of how we do capital projects. And you can see the interest payments will continue to decline as the principal's repaid, but this was true not only at the state level, but for a lot of the local government pension obligation bonds that were sold at the time. So that's assuming that you're always going to have more revenue to pay more debt. They were 25-year bonds, and when they're paid off in full in 2027, that'll be great. As I mentioned, they were taxable, and what that means is that it's more like a corporate debt, and that meant that in the case when the state sold it, they were not callable. So the state, even though interest rates have dropped to a point where we could have probably refunded them and saved hundreds, you know, tens of millions of dollars, we cannot call those bonds, we cannot restructure these bonds. There's very few taxable bond deals that offer those features, which is really typical in our world of tax exempt. So the sad truth is that in the last few years, I would have loved to have refinanced just this existing debt because it would have been a great thing for the state, but that just wasn't in the cards. Briefly, the state does provide guarantees on local government, as I said, school districts and community colleges through what's known as a fund diversion agreement. In 2001, the legislature authorized Department of Education to enter into fund diversion agreements, which means that we're taking the state aid that goes to schools and community colleges and we're putting it in a lockbox and we're sending it to the trustee to pay the debt service on their pension bonds, which are not voter approved general obligation bonds, and so they wouldn't have had quite as good a credit rating because the state authorized us to, basically the Department of Education, to do that. All those bonds that were sold in those pools, and there's over $3 billion in those bonds, had the same credit rating as the state, which was good for them because it lowered their interest cost. But this chart shows you the annual debt service since the first issue of those bonds. So you can see it's a growing amount of money in terms of our state aid. They had the same upward sloping amortization for their bonds as we did. And at this point, about 7% or a little over $278 million in state school aid is being diverted as we speak to pay for debt service on existing local government POBs. We have some other state guarantees, and just what it shows you, the upper blue is our school bond guarantee for the capital projects. Now, it's all contingent liability, but if you add the two together, the contingent liability plus the real money that we're moving every year, it's just north of 20% of state aid in one way or other is tied up in a bond guarantee. So that's just something to consider as we're looking at whether more local government POBs make sense with the state guaranteeing it. I mentioned to you that we tell the rating agencies every time we meet with them the new information on PERS. So we just had those meetings here in actually Portland during the big snowstorm and ice storm. That was an exciting time to be trying to meet with them, but we got through it. Besides caring about our bonding levels and our pension liability, they care about our budget, our governance structure, our economy, and our management. I'm happy to report that we reconfirmed by all three agencies as the AA, AA1 level with a stable outlook. And that's not to minimize the problems we have with PERS and the budget crises that the PERS system we can see coming forward. But I think you need to understand, in relatively speaking, most communities in the country are facing the same set of problems with a lower earning environment and trying to manage through this difficult time. So we get strong marks, for better or for worse, for strong financial management, for planning ahead, for the PERS reforms that we did in the 2000s, and in general for being a fairly well-managed place. We're never going to be a AAA so long as we have a major single source of revenue, which is personal income, because we don't have the diversification of our revenue streams, and we have the initiative process. So this is about as good a rating as I anticipate that the state can have at the current time.
Excuse me, pardon me, Senator Johnson.
Ms. Lockwood-McCall, if someone came to you and said, well, it's AAA+, I mean, it's AA+, And we've gotten high marks for maintaining a fiscally disciplined approach. That ought to be Exhibit A in doing nothing. And just, you know, fly it and watch it. What would your response be?
Complicated. I think that they watch us, and they watched our COLA reform attempts that didn't succeed. I don't know that I have a perfect answer as to whether we should do something or not. I think that we tried to show them our rate coloring approach, and this doesn't solve the problem from a budget perspective at all, but we showed them that we fund what the actuaries tell us to fund, and PERS folks have done scenarios at 7% returns, 5% returns, and as long as we follow that budget discipline, it shows, painful as it may be, that we will be okay, because the methodology and the fact that we do budget and fund what the actuaries tell us to fund, that is part of why we still have good marks, because we're thinking about it and we're looking ahead.
Follow?
Yes, sir.
How fragile is that rating? And by that question, I mean, were we to do nothing? Were we to do something that the rating agencies deem detrimental? How easily tipped over could that AA-plus be?
At the risk of going down in flames for saying this through the chair, I think we're at stable outlook. I don't think we're in a fragile place. Step back. Our economy is one of the strongest in terms of growth in the country. We have
been with only 6% revenue.
As I mentioned, they care about, do we balance our budget? Do we have mechanisms in place to balance budget? I mean, I'm not saying it's easy or it's nice or it's kind, the budget cuts we have to do, but they recognize that we have growing revenues, budget discipline. Our debt loads are moderate to slightly high because we do have POBs on our books. But overall, you know, the great majority of states are in the AA, AA+. We're in the bunch, truthfully. Yes, our revenues aren't growing as fast. I think they'd recognize that there's a greater issue nationwide. That we're in the same soup as lots of other places. And it's, you know, I know it's crazy, but it's all relative to how do we manage it versus how other folks manage it. If I could beg your indulgence to show you this chart. This was recently produced by Standard & Poor's. What's interesting about it is they looked at all 50 states, their OPEB liability, which is other post-employment benefits, health care. They looked at your debt per capita, and they looked at your PERS liability per capita. One caveat, they took it out of annual CAFRs, and our CAFR that they took it out of didn't include the Morrow decision. Okay, but what the green line shows you is you add up those three different bars, because some people have pension bonds, but they don't have much liability, or some people have a lot of liability, but they don't have pension bonds. So they were trying to make it apples to apples. The green line tells you what the gross state product is. So when we talk about resources across the country, we're right kind of in the middle. And I think even after the Morrow decision gets folded into our balance sheet, the people on the far right, Connecticut, New Jersey, Hawaii, and a few other, Illinois, they bonded a lot of pension bonds for operating costs.
Mm.
Okay, so they financed their normal costs, not just their unfunded liability. Mm-hmm. Both New Jersey and Illinois have done that. I'm not saying that it isn't easy, but I don't think that we're anywhere near their tipping scale at the moment. That's the best I can offer.
Thank you.
What was one more? What was so special about Virginia that it deserved the red arrow?
Oh, it was supposed to be Oregon, but I guess when somebody transposed it over.
Cool.
But I used to work there, and you know what? They're a AAA, and they're not that far away from Oregon at the AA+. So, okay. Sorry about that, about the red arrow. Again, should we sell more? I think that's a decision ultimately for the legislature and the governor to grapple with. There's the potential of saving money, but it's speculative. And of course, we have a lot of capital needs. The governor's got $969 million of general fund supported debt in the budget. If we sold pension bonds, either we're going to go above our debt ratios that we've had in place for a long time that we try and maintain, or else we have to crowd out needed capital projects. Thank you for your opportunity to speak to you.
Any other questions, Senator Mona Sanderson?
This is an area of not my expertise. I'm a nurse. I don't get into these financial things.
You might need a nurse.
That's right. When we're paying off our bonds, who does that interest go to?
Through the chair. Senator Anderson, we sell our bonds in the public markets to all different kinds of investors. We sell through, you know, underwriters who underwrite, and then they sell to everything from what we call mom and pop retail, which is really mostly orthodontists and dentists, all the way up to massive, large mutual funds that buy municipal bonds. And so it's a vast market of all different kinds of investors who receive the benefit of the interest that we pay.
Okay, and then just a follow-up.
Yes.
You know, there's been talk, not this session, but previous sessions, about a state bank. And I was just wondering, maybe bonds wouldn't even fit into a state bank, but would a state bank save us money through...
Through the chair, it's above my pay grade to answer that, but I think of my different bond indentures and the bond programs we do as little mini banks. You know, we have a bond program that says bonding for first-time home buyers, and Oregon Housing does loans through different, you know, financial institutions to lots of home buyers. I sell bonds. We do loans for energy improvements. So the state bank is a big bank for cashing checks, but if you think about the kind of borrowing and lending we do at the state, in essence, we're kind of doing that. Maybe not quite in the same four corners as North Dakota, but I don't
think North Dakota does.
They have a real state bank. They created it during the Depression. It's a different animal than the kind of things we do, but we provide a lot of services to Oregonians through Treasury that are the kinds of things you think about when you think of that. If you will, because I'm out in the capital markets borrowing money for state agencies who either make grants or loans to all different kinds of things.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you so much. That was very informative. I appreciate
thank you.
That. Okay, I'm going to call up John Shervam, Chief Investment Officer from the Oregon State Treasury.
Oh, I fell over. Thank you.
Hello.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is John Shervam. I'm the Investment Division Director and the Chief Investment Officer for the Oregon State Treasury. I have, I think, seven slides that I wanted to share with you. But before I do, I would ask that I, too, am not entirely clear how germane what I've prepared is for you, so I hope you would stop me at any point and interrupt with questions.
So just before you get going, we invited you to talk about, there's a lot of discussion about increasing earnings in order to pay off the debt, and we are wanting to have all these conversations out in the public forum so that people can understand what it is that, you know, what your office does.
Sure.
Chief, you know, you have the Oregon Investment Council, you are the Chief Investment Officer at the Oregon State Treasurer. For the public to understand that we have this $92 billion or whatever it is, and it's being invested, and that's part of paying for PERS benefits, and et cetera. And there's people talk in the general public about, and in this building, that we could increase the earnings, make different investments, and then we could help pay for the unfunded liability. And so we wanted you to come and talk about what it is exactly that your office does, what your responsibilities are, the Investment Council, and the earnings part of the equation, if you will, so that everyone understands what it is you're capable of doing and what it is that maybe not capable of doing. So, if that helps.
Thank you for that direction, Chair Taylor. It helps very much. So, this is what the Investment Division of the Oregon State Treasury manages. As of the end of last calendar year, it was approximately $93 billion. The biggest part of that is the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, otherwise known as OPERF. That is the pool of assets that is earmarked in trust expressly to pay benefits to PERS members. The other assets are the short-term fund, which is essentially the money market for the state, and then various other state agency accounts. This is the asset allocation of OPERF. So this is how the assets are invested by asset class. Capital markets on the left. This is what I would encourage you to think of as the plain vanilla investments in stocks and bonds. Now there are stock and bond investments that are global in nature, but they are stock and bond investments in that they are highly liquid and very scalable. So that is the liquid, scalable part of the portfolio. It comprises, round numbers, about 60% of the assets of OPERF. The right-hand side are the alternative investments. That's fancy nomenclature for private market investments, and those are the more challenging in the sense that they are illiquid oftentimes. They can be more exotic, and more often than not, they are the higher returning assets. It is what I would encourage you to think of as the complicated part of the portfolio. So the left-hand side is plain vanilla. The right-hand side is much more complicated. The left-hand side is very scalable, meaning we can hang a bunch of zeros on those mandates and not add any, not add a proportion number of people or technology. It's very scalable. In fact, those are the assets that we increasingly manage internally to save money. The right-hand side is not scalable. The right-hand side is a complicated boots-on-the-ground business. As you will see in a later slide, though, the right-hand side is what drives the premium returns that Oregon has achieved over the years. I won't go further into it other than to say every particular asset class, whether it's public equity, private equity, alternatives, fixed income, every particular asset class has a very deliberate role in the portfolio. So I have introduced with the council and staff the idea of a 70s rock band where you have lead guitar, rhythm guitar, bass, drums, keyboard, harmonica. It only works when everybody sticks to their role in the band, and that's the same with the portfolio. Is if we get somebody in real estate trying to play lead guitar, things start to break down. So this is really the punchline slide. This is performance for OPERF, for the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, over the past 10 years. The top part of the slide shows you benchmark returns. These are the returns that have been available over this decade in the marketplace. The line in the middle that starts with OPERF on the left, that is the actual performance of the fund. And the number in the brackets is our relative ranking, our ranking relative to our peer group. Our peer group are public plans with assets $10 billion and above. That's our what's called our cohort. So public U.S. plans with assets greater than $10 billion. We are within days of receiving our 2016 relative results. Our absolute results are in. OPERF earned 6.9% net in calendar year 2016. But the company, Wilshire Associates, that compiles the peer group data has not released the peer group rankings. So regrettably, I'm a day or two premature to share with you what our relative returns are for 2016. So this information is as of December 31st, 2015. And as you can see on the far right-hand side, our relative ranking in our cohort over that period was number one. So to the extent people among your constituents or in the building or ask you what we can do on the earnings side, I would respond, where do you go from number one?
Yeah.
I don't have another gear on the investment side to go to. Okay. That's not to say we will always and forever be number one, but it is to say that the investment side is doing its job.
Pardon me.
I want to go back to your rock band analogy, just because this might be a point of edification for all of us. Periodically in this building, a temptation sweeps through for the legislature to begin telling you and the investment board and your managers what kinds of investments we ought to be favoring or, frankly, prohibiting some. How upsetting is that legislative interference to your rock band analogy in terms of your very high-performing and balanced portfolio?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, I think the performance is perhaps the performance of OPERF, the performance of the program in general, but the performance of OPERF in particular is the best response to that. And, you know, I'm still a newcomer. I've been here 4 years. I didn't create that performance. I inherited it. It's performance that every Oregonian should be proud of. And so I would just say, in response to that suggestion, the investment division, the Oregon Investment Council, the staff, everybody's rowing pretty hard, and the results of those efforts manifest in a rating that's pretty impressive. So why would we want to do anything else?
And if you'll indulge me, just to put this as clearly as I think I heard you say it, for people, however you want to define that, to rely on an accelerated performance out of our portfolio to solve this problem is completely unrealistic. Where do you go from one? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's what I heard you say.
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, the ranking is a relative ranking. It's a ranking relative to our peers. And why is that important? Well, it's important because we actually compete against our peers. We compete in private markets, in public markets, against our peers. So that ranking is relative to our peers. It's not an absolute ranking, or it's not an absolute. The absolute return is what we actually earn. We earned 6.9% net of all fees in 2016. That's what we earned.
Which is pretty good.
Which is pretty good, but it's south of the assumed rate in the PERS calculations.
Right.
And the point is, the Oregon Investment Council, the investment division, we do not control absolute returns. Absolute returns are what are available to us. So I frequently remind people that the investment division, the Oregon Investment Council, we are returns takers, not returns makers. We take returns that are available to us. We actually harvest returns that are available to us in the market. We do not make returns. Returns makers are people in policy positions like Barack Obama, now Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, Janet Yellen. Fiscal monetary policymakers ultimately make returns. We harvest returns. If we do our jobs well, we harvest those returns as cheaply and efficiently as possible, and we add a little bit extra. The great investment tradition in Oregon is we have been able to add a little bit extra, but we cannot control nor create levels of absolute return.
Thank you.
Can you just go back to the slide that you had up with? Oh, here it is. So when you're pointing to the number one, and then we have these other categories where you're like the domestic equity 1 year, it says 75 next to it, just pulling one out of here. Is the goal for all of these to get to one?
Sure.
Yeah, so I'm just wanting to flush this out. This is not meant to be any kind of a criticism, because I know you're working very hard at this, and the returns really are impressive. So if someone were to make the argument that, you know, we should be striving, I mean, I would assume you already are trying to get to number one in all these categories, and you probably do look at what it would mean for returns if you were number one, but these may be out of your control. You see what I'm saying? If you could move those up to number one, I assume how much of a difference, or do you know what a difference it would make in the earnings? But I don't know off the top of your head. But.
Chair Taylor, let me retract my previous sure, because it's not necessarily the case that we want to be number one in every asset class. Back to the rock band analogy, there's part of that is like saying you want every instrument to play as loud as possible, which isn't necessarily the case.
Okay.
I shared with you the rock band analogy to impress upon you the importance that the asset classes and the individuals that manage those asset classes work together, that there is very deliberate choreography. And so the portfolio is built not with the asset classes in isolation, but collectively as a band.
Okay.
And so there are years when one asset class will be below its peer group median, and there will be actually very good and deliberate reasons for that, because that asset class has been designed, back to my earlier statement, it's been designed to play a very particular role. Not only in terms of return generation, but more importantly in the rock band analogy, in terms of risk mitigation.
And then I suppose also that in the number that I pulled out, the number 75 for the domestic equity, I suppose the whoever 74 and 76, you could be just a hair off of one or the other. So there may not even be this substantial gain in this one area, even if you wanted that to be. It could be just a slight variation, I would imagine.
Chair Taylor, that's correct, that mere basis points separate these relative rankings. And just for the committee's information, a basis point is 1/100th of a percentage point. It's 0.0001. And so the one-year numbers will have a very high volatility. And staff and the Oregon Investment Council really de-emphasize short-term numbers, because we have an investment horizon that is 20 years. And so we're sailing a super tanker through the seas, and we want to make sure it's double hulled, and we don't pay a lot of attention, frankly, to, you know, the what's happening right around us. We're looking way across the horizon.
Okay. Sir, also I think for Debbie here, maybe just a skosh back on the microphone for the sound.
Sure.
Thanks. Please, thank you. Okay, moving along.
This is the investment division as it's currently comprised, 31 positions, four of which are vacant under recruiting at the moment. And I draw your attention to the green box on the side, because that is what is new to our org chart. That is the result of the POP that was approved by the legislature last year, or in the last full session. And we are the very grateful and fortunate beneficiaries of that, because we have added capabilities to the organization that didn't exist before. And just to put some numbers on it, have resulted already in the identification of over $800 million in errors among our various vendors. Mm-hmm. And these are eyes and ears and sets of hands that we just didn't have before. And so they have given us, they have raised our game in terms of rigor and analysis like you just can't even believe. It's been terrific. And to the extent our additional asks are approved, we expect to see commensurate improvements in terms of the efficiency of our operation.
Senator Johnson.
When you said they identified $800 million in errors,
Senator Taylor, Chair Taylor and Senator Johnson, yes, $803 million in errors.
And is there errors and omissions insurance that you can call on? Is there something in the contract? What, whose detriment or benefit did that $800 million redound to?
The Senator, Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, they're not. It's not $800 million that we lost. It's reporting mistakes. We are under, of course, an appropriate scrutiny, level of scrutiny, and so we use the information that is provided by various vendors and make our reports. And it turns out oftentimes there's mistakes in the information that our own vendors give us. And so these resources have enabled us to build, again, I'm going to use some nomenclature, middle and back office capabilities that we didn't have before. And the upshot is that the rigor that we can now apply helps us identify errors, hopefully catch them before they get published in reports, only to be, you know, where we in the past either we don't catch the errors or we have to come back months later and fix them. So again, I can't impress upon you enough how important those resources are and how well they've been integrated and improved our operations.
I'm Senator delighted Johnson. To hear that. There was some controversy surrounding this, and I'm thrilled that we went ahead and made the investment. Having said that, I just want to say for the purpose that I may have caused some lack of clarity, these were not fiscal losses. They were reporting errors that might have had ramifications, but we were able to catch them expeditiously.
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, that is correct. There were reporting errors that have been caught and rectified.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Another punchline slide. Again, as grateful as we are for the additional resources and as well as we think they've been employed.
I'm so sorry that I'm not going to be able
to. Here's where we rank relative to our peer group. Again, that this is a slightly different cohort. This is a cohort of global institutional investors. It's from the CEM Global Leaders composite. These are peer programs globally that match Oregon in terms of size, but more importantly in terms of complexity. Again, the Oregon program is large, but it's also very complex. It's one of the more complex investment portfolios in the country and frankly in the world. And so this is a cohort that matches us both in size and complexity, and you can see that despite the additional resources that we gained in the last session, we are still quite lean and mean. And you know, it's great to be consistent with the pioneering Lewis and Clark tradition, but we're starting to push it a little too far, being at the bottom, being at the very at or near the bottom of our cohort in terms of resources.
I have a question on that.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
But are we maybe compensating you at a better than maybe some of these others that have maybe more staff but maybe not the quality that seems to be in our system?
Chair Taylor, Senator Anderson, I would say this is completely independent of compensation. And I would need, you know, an additional slide to demonstrate compensation. So this is just the bodies and chairs necessary to get the work done, independent of compensation. And it actually is less attractive than this, because the work has to get done. So to the extent we don't have the bodies, then we hire consultants. And consultants come at about, you know, three times the cost of what it takes. You know, if we had bodies in the seats, and to the extent we don't have enough, then we're going to pay external vendors, consultants, about three times the cost of what it would be to have internal staff.
Any other questions? Just so you know, Senator Johnson and I in the last session served on this general government subcommittee of Ways and Means. And so when then Treasurer Wheeler came forward and asked for these positions, it came through the subcommittee that Senator Johnson and I served on, and we heard the whole discussion, and Senator Johnson's absolutely correct. It was quite a process because this was adding several positions, but it was, you know, I thought that the Treasurer's Office did a good job of explaining the benefit to the state of bringing some of these people in-house. Some things they can bring in-house, some, of course, they cannot. And so I'm glad to hear that it's helping to make things run a little bit better. Does anybody have any other? This is our opportunity, folks. This is the expert on how these $93 billion, I see it as probably the most awesome responsibility in the state, in the sense that it is definitely the largest sum that any one entity has overseen, unless you're going to tell me otherwise. Shervam, I believe that is the biggest responsibility right there, is overseeing this.
I'm going to make a comment rather than pose a question, because I don't want to put our chief investment officer in an awkward situation. But I have, having seen this display of how well we are doing, I don't think it should be lost on anyone that the chair of the Oregon Investment Council, outgoing chair, Ms. Durant, has written a letter that functionally sounds the alarm for why it is PERS is an important issue to deal with. And I am enormously respectful of her service as an Oregonian, and I would hope that the entire committee has seen the letter. Several editorials were written as a result of her admonition that this is unsustainable. And I would commend it for your consideration if you need to see the person who has spearheaded this kind of return in managing the portfolio managers and managing the whole portfolio. It is a very sobering set of recommendations, and I do not ask you to respond.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Knopf, is there anything you wanted to ask? I have a feeling there must be something you
wanted to
ask.
Oh, there is. I really wanted to ask where you can invest the $93 billion and double our return next year.
Would you like to answer that? Yes, it was
legal.
Legal. Thank yes, you. We only participate legal. In legal activities here. Well, thank you very much for. We may ask you to come back up, but for now, thank you for taking the time out to come and explain that to us. It was very educational. We really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah, so now we're going to have Mr. Rodman again. He's just, we actually have a little room. We have our little room for Mr. Rodman in the back. We do let him go home and see his family at night. And then we ask him to keep coming back and coming back to explain things in detail for us. So what are we going to talk about today? UAL.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, Steve Rodman, Executive Director of the Public Employer Retirement System. I would summarize the conversation as looking at the mechanics or the gears behind the C. In other words, how does the PERS board go through the processes that they do to derive the employer contribution? And when you talk in terms of financing, what are the pieces of that analysis that are subject to some sort of change? And what are the drivers of the contribution rates that we have today, and what could be considered to affect those contributions. So I very much appreciate the chair starting the meeting with the conversation about the formula, because I always try to start there. So we're focusing again on the contribution piece. You heard Mr. Sherman talk about the E piece at some length, and I would only say that it serves Oregon well to have these two components of the formula under two different structures and two different areas of responsibility, because it is the level of professionalism that Mr. Shervin and the OIC can bring to the investment group is unparalleled, as you've seen in the results. So the contribution rate setting cycle, just again to remind everybody, we go on an 18-month lag, meaning that we have rates already adopted that are going to go into effect July 1 of 2017. And those rates are based on the valuation results of that formula balance, the BC plus E, that formula balance as of the end of 2015. The rates we're paying today in 15-17 were based on the 13 valuation. The rates we will pay in 2019 are based on the 17 valuation. So that 18-month lag gets built into this cycle. The cycle is driven by the statute, as most things are that the PERS board deals with. They are directed to talk they are directed to generate a report at least every 2 years that evaluates current and prospective assets and liabilities, in other words, the B, C, and E, addresses mortality, disability, service, and other types of experience for the members, and recommends make recommendations to facilitate administration. That every 2 year admonition in the statute, actually we do more than that. We do actuarial reports every year, but the purpose of the reports is different from 1 year to the next. So that's what I wanted to take some time to explain today. The even numbered years, so the valuation report that we will do for 2016, the year we just closed, is what's called an experience study. The experience study is where we look at how did the patterns of behavior and experience of our membership compare to assumption? So we assume a certain number of people are going to retire in any given year, or withdraw, or frankly die. And how did the actual experience of that population mirror or match the assumptions that we made? Because if you don't look at reality versus your assumption, you can get off track. So we do the experience study every 2 years. And that's, again, in the even-numbered years. the odd-numbered years, so 2015 that drove the 17 rates, 2017 that will drive the 19 rates, the odd-numbered year valuations are the rate-setting valuations. So the two valuations serve two different purposes. One is to see how on track are we comparing assumption to reality. The other is, given that track, what adjustments do we have to make in the rate to get us back on track? So the experience study, the even year report, looks at the economic and demographic profile of employers and members. How many people are coming into public service? At what level? What are the salary increases? Are they leaving the workforce, staying in the workforce? All the different dynamics you can imagine. Also included in that analysis are the economic assumptions, like expected inflation, real investment return, and we look over the next 20 years. So it's the experience study where we look at the demographics and we look at the economics. So the experience study is where we will, for example, look at the assumed rate of return that we think the portfolio will generate over the next 20 years. And that is a question then that the PERS board will address this summer, because the 2016 valuation, which again, close of the last calendar year, the actuary takes all the data that we have accumulated about our members and again, experience and all that, and also looks at all the assumptions we had, inflation, real rate of return, all of those, and comes up with a recommendation in the 2016 valuation report for changes to actuarial methods and assumptions. So one of those assumptions, again, is the assumed rate. That will be looked at in July and adopted to be effective for the 2016 valuation. Then those assumptions and methods that are adopted for 2016 will be used in 2017 to set the employer contribution rates. So it's that repeated cycle that we go through, the even years where we look at basically the guts, and then the odd years are when we actually apply the results of that to generate employer contribution rates. So in the last cycle, for example, in 2014, we looked at the increases in the unfunded actuarial liability because of the various causes. You saw this slide before in my presentation. We talked about the Morrow decision, but also the fact that 2014 investment returns were below the assumed rate generated an additional unfunded liability. We decreased the assumed rate of return to 7.5%. Updated mortality assumptions, et cetera, generated, or an unfunded liability was recognized in that 14 valuation of $9.5 billion. And then in 2015, we had to deal with, again, investment returns below assumption and some other factors that we note there to include another unfunded liability slice of $3.8 billion. So all told, 14 and 15 increased the unfunded liability or an increase in the unfunded liability of some $13.3 billion was recognized through those two valuations. And that's where that layered on top of the unfunded liability we had from 2013 to result in the $21.8 billion number that everybody's heard. So the 21.8, 13.3 of that came out of the valuations from 2014 and 2015. Did I lose you?
No, you didn't. Thank you. You didn't lose me, but so what was it in 2013?
In 2013, the unfunded liability was some $8 billion.
And how, over what period of years did that take to grow?
That was accumulative.
But, I mean, did it have a big spike like this? I mean, the 9.5 is huge.
No, it's mostly, Chair Taylor, it's mostly a carryover from the 2008 investment downturn.
Okay. So it took from 2008 to 2013 to get to the...
To kind of whittle it down. We also had... So we had investment returns above assumption in many of those years. We had one reduction in the assumed rate from 8 to 7.75. So these different dynamics come into play every 2 years. And it's just... You started then at this total UAL in 2013 of 8.5. You add on the 13.3, you get to the 21.8.
So I guess I'm still trying to because of the Morrow adjustment. What was the big that? Because that number is so much bigger. The Morrow adjustment, because we had assumed that we would not have to be paying out as much in benefits. Is that what you're? And now we had to basically pay that back, and we didn't have a.
So Chair Taylor, what happened in the 2013 valuation was, because the legislature passed the COLA reductions in 2013, the legislature directed us, the PERS board and the actuary, its actuaries, to redo the 2013 valuation based on that benefit reduction and to reissue 2013 employer contribution rates. When those benefit reductions were overturned, came back on the books, for lack of a better term, that created the unfunded liability that was recognized in 14.
It's a pretty serious increase. Yes, Senator Knoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, the UAL increase of the $1.7 billion because of the decrease in the assumed rate, that was a move of 0.25%. Is that correct?
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knoop, that's correct.
So can we expect follow up?
Yes, that's okay.
Can we expect that every quarter point is going to be roughly $1.7 billion in unfunded liability?
Chair Taylor, Senator Knoop, I don't know that it's that correlative, but pretty close.
Okay.
So, of course, I have to ask about 2016. How's it looking?
Chair Taylor, we will go through a process of evaluating the projections from the Oregon Investment Council's experts as well as from the PERS board experts. While those decisions or those projections haven't been finalized, the pressure, I think, will certainly be to reduce the assumed rate.
Okay. Would you mind, just because Senator Gelser had to step out, as we often do, to go testify on something else, I believe, and now Senator Johnson also came back. These two numbers, this $9.5 billion and this $3.8 billion here, are significant. And I just, if you could just for a few sentences, just update them on what you said.
Okay.
Just a few sentences, that would be great.
Sure. So this is just going through the actuarial process of saying, in 2014, we look at our experience study and we say, when I say we, I mean the PERS actuary. The PERS actuary looks at what did we assume was going to happen versus what actually happened and what do we actually project. And so in 2014, we realized, back to that equation of B equals C plus C, they had understated the B because the Morrow decision added more benefits into the picture, and also we lowered the assumed rate so the E isn't growing as quickly. So it added those two things plus the updating mortality assumptions added $9.5 billion to the unfunded liability in 2014 when the actuaries looked again at the relative balance of that formula. In 2015, the biggest driver of the change there was the fact that in 2015, investments did not return did not equal the assumed rate of return. So again, we didn't make as much money in 2015 as we had projected we would do. That added to the unfunded liability. So cumulatively, the 2014 experience and the 2015 experience of increases in the unfunded liability factored into the 2015 valuation, which was used to set rates for 2017. So we knew between the rates we're paying now and the rates we are going to be paying starting July 1, 2017, we have to recover another $13.3 billion in unfunded liability.
I know you were about to ask something, Senator Knoop. I just want to, so for 16, we're waiting for, you're not quite there yet to know what the numbers will be. And of course, I don't know what all of you know, but I'm just trying to understand this going forward. Is there something that we need to be calculating differently for our assumptions? Is there something that we could be doing?
And go ahead. And
I'm sorry.
To clarify questions.
Anyway, I don't.
So, Chair Taylor, this is why. That we, who's we? Is it the legislature or the PERS board? There are several things the PERS board needs to be doing. They need to recognize, for example, as Mr. Shervin noted, that in 2016, by his calculation, the fund returned 6.99%, and that is less than the assumed rate. We have not finished our earnings crediting. We don't do that until our April meeting. There will be some moving pieces in that. So, did we, and by the time we finished crediting earnings, did we reach our assumption in that respect? Let's look at the assumed rate of return going forward. We're at 7.5%. Should we probably drop that? And if so, that means, again, the E is smaller, so that factors into the consideration of what the pressure there will be in contributions. Frankly, what happened with benefits? Probably not much in terms of did more people retire or fewer people retire, any of those kinds of dynamics. I mean, they're pretty predictable now, again, barring changes from the legislature. that changed the basics of the program. So the PERS board pays very close attention to all of these different drivers and working them into the contribution formula. For the legislature, you have to know that the actions you take on the B side of the formula are going to have the flow-through effect on these unfunded liabilities, positively or negatively.
Okay, so I think Senator Knope is first up, then I think Senator Gelsert, and then Senator Johnson.
If you had a clarifying question about that, please feel free.
I did, just because I missed the initial introduction to the slide. Just so that I understand the enormity of what I think you've just said, the expected increase was $0.2 billion, but the actual increase was $9.5 billion.
Chair Taylor, Senator Gelsert, no, that's a different, the meaning of that line is different, so
okay.
Let me explain that.
Thank you. So you weren't off by $9.3 billion?
We were off by 9.5.
Oh, okay.
because
for
so
those reasons.
That first line that you see, both in 14 and 15, okay, is because we have this rate collar policy,
right,
that limits. So we know if we don't charge the full employer rate this biennium, we know the unfunded liability is going to go up.
Okay.
So we knew, because of the rate collar, the unfunded liability was already going to go up that $0.2 million in 2014. And that line is higher, you see, in 2015, because we're collaring off more. In the future, should you have the unfortunate responsibility of hearing me talk about this again in 2 years, that number is going to be even higher because, again, we're collaring more off. So we expect the unfunded liability to go up. The other factors were things we did not expect that were different from the base methods and assumptions we used for 2013.
Senator Johnson.
I'm going to ask you a very undiplomatic question, but it comes in the terms that my constituents correspond with me about, some of them. And it goes something like this. Why don't those idiots decrease the assumed rate of return? And when you and I talked about it, you indicated to me, and your slide here indicates, that to change that 8% or 7.5, it accelerates the problem. It does not decrease the problem. And could you put a finer point on that explanation?
Certainly. Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, if I may, I go back to my favorite slide.
I bet you've got that tattooed on your back. It's a good
visual. There's
a good
question I prefer not to answer. Senator Taylor, the E component of this is an assumption going forward. So you assume, at least at the last time we did this in the 2015 valuation, we assumed we would earn 7.5%. So why doesn't the PERS board, when the PERS board does reduce the assumed rate, in the circumstances that they do that, the E shrinks? You understand algebra. The E goes down, the B stays constant, the C has to go up. So, yes, to the extent that we drop the assumed rate, the contribution rate has to go up because the assumed rate does not affect the benefits that members are actually being paid. So, yes, you drop the assumed rate, contribution rates go up. More money has to come from employers.
I think that is very poorly understood out there in constituent land.
Okay, Senator Knope.
Steve, as it relates to the earnings, and we're going to be short, but we're not going to be real short. So I can't remember how you guys do this, but when you credit, do you credit the difference from the gain loss reserve on an annual basis? Or are we just kind of carrying that and we square it up at the end?
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knope, as I will explain later, when you're talking about, okay, I'll back up, sorry. We credit earnings every year. So it's a different exercise than what Mr. Shervin talked about. He looks at a change in portfolio value and says it's 6.99%. What we do is we take the bucket of money that we have available to credit at 2016, the end of the year, and spread that over the accounts that receive crediting. Side note quickly for Tier 1. Tier 1 members get the assumed rate. So they get 7.5% every year. When we drop it, if we drop it, they get less. If earnings are insufficient to credit the Tier 1 accounts at the assumed rate, there is a rate guarantee reserve that is funded by Tier 1 earnings in excess of assumed rates, and that reserve is used to credit up to the assumed rate for Tier 1. The other reserves, Tier 2, benefits and forest employers, get actual earnings and losses. If in 2016, as I think you're positing, we get less than the assumed rate in those reserves, there is no gain-loss reserve to fill those holes. But 2016 is not a rate-setting year. We combine 2016's returns with 2017 returns before we credit, before we set contribution rates. So Mr. Shervram has 11 more months to 10 and a half to make up for the returns under the assumed rate in 2016 before it will affect employer contribution rates going forward. If the rally continues and we have 2017 and 16 combined at the assumed rate, then there will be the formula will remain in its relative balance.
We are generally pretty happy people, I would like to say, for all of us. It's just this thing that comes over us on Mondays and Wednesdays at around 4:15. I've just noticed, you know, time together as a committee this session. I just wanted to say it. And I really want to thank Senator Johnson for bringing some humor into the room as we go through this process. So, next slide.
All right. So, it's important to move from this slide to the next. So here, as you see, we have $13.8 billion in unfunded liability that was recognized in the valuations for 14 and 15. What we do in deriving employer contribution rates is we take that slice from 14 and 15, and it is amortized then across employers, using three different financing factors. And I'm sorry, Chair Taylor, this is finally to the point of financing.
Yes.
That unfunded liability, that $13.3 billion, is then assessed against employer contribution rates over 20 years as a level percent of payroll over 20 years using our current assumed rate. So we basically assume we're going to pay that off as a percentage of payroll, meaning that in the case of the 2015 valuation, which is the results that we produced, 16.06% of employer, 16.06% of payroll is what it's going to take to pay this unfunded liability off over 20 years.
Did you say 16%?
16.06%, yes.
Okay, say all of that again, please.
So, thank you, because I didn't get it all together.
I just want to make sure that these details are significant.
Taking that unfunded liability from 2014 and 15 and assessing it against employers.
You're just seeing 14 and 15. You're not seeing the total.
Right.
Okay. All right, just making sure I'm tracking. Okay.
Taking that and applying it to a level percent of payroll over 20 years. Combined with the unfunded liability we carried over, that 8.5 that we had before.
Oh, yeah, just that.
Just that. That's 16.6% of payroll in 2017-19. So 16% of the PERS rate would be charged. We would charge 16% of payroll. My point is that's a level percent over time. So that 16 stays at that level until the amortization period closes. What that does is, as Ms. Lockwood McCall's demonstration of the repayment of the bond shows, it accelerates over time because payroll grows. So 16% of payroll is going to be a larger number every year because payroll is going to grow. So my point in how we do this is, we take that slice of the unfunded liability, the 13.3, we assess that as a percentage of payroll over 20 years at the assumed rate, 7.5%. If everything ran to assumption for the next 20 years, that rate would drop off and be gone.
But in the meantime, during the course of that 20 years, what's the highest that you can prognosticate that it conceivably could get?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, there's so many dynamics to that with the rate collar, funded status, all of those things. The projections that we showed you in my earlier presentation showed employer contribution rates going to some 30% of payroll. And that, and again, given that unfunded actuarial liability rate, that my point is, of course, that so much of that 30% is the unfunded liability rate. And this is how we get there. 20 years, 7.5% assumed rate, level percent of payroll.
One follow-up.
Senator Johnson.
One would be tempted to think that if you monkeyed around with this calculation, that you could reduce that 30% given the number of variables. 30% is used as a very frightening number with school boards and others when they're talking about what that will result in the classroom. Am I correct to assume that there is not much flexibility in manipulating the calculation and that that 30% is more likely to be realized than not?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, that's the bulk of my presentation I'm hoping to get to.
Oh, sorry.
As soon as we lay the groundwork. Because that is exactly the point as far as financing options. Three things: 20 years, assumed rate, level percent of payroll. Those are the only three changes that you could make to make that rate different. So you could go from 20 to 30, for example, and we'll show you what that looks like. You could, instead of saying as a level percent of payroll, we want a straight dollar amount, the same dollar amount. Well, the dollar amount now would have to go up, it would go down in later years. We could refinance that debt at a lower cost. That's what Ms. Lockwood McCall's presentation was all about. Instead of 7.5%, you could conceivably issue a bond and finance that debt at a lower cost. As she said, bond capacity, all those things could constrain you. Market conditions would make that imprudent. But those are the financing pieces that there are to play with or to manipulate or change. And I guess the point of my presentation today is, what are the consequences of the amortization piece of that, the 20-year piece? Because the assumed rate is what Ms. Lockwood McCall already taught to you about. And the percent of payroll has the consequences it does, but there's already enough pressure on employer contributions. You probably don't want to raise or change that financing structure. Instead, let's talk about what changing 20 years would do. So, because of the rate collar, we all know that full cost of that unfunded liability is working its way into the system over the next couple of years. Couple of bienniums. We limit the rate collar, and again, this is a slide you've seen previously. We limit the rate collar in the amount that employer contributions can change from one biennium to the next. And this is to show, back to you, Senator Gelster, about the expected increase in the unfunded liability. This is the current and projected unfunded liability. We know it's going to grow because of the rate collar, we're not paying the full amount currently. So we expect that the unfunded liability is going to grow over the next several biennia until we get the top of the rate collar and those 30% rates that we've shown you before. So, as I said previously, every time that we do a rate setting report, we reassess the unfunded actuarial liability slice. So by that I mean, in 14-15, we know we came up with that $13.3 billion. For 16-17, let's say that earnings do not reach the assumed rate in 2017 and 16. So there's another piece of unfunded liability that is created. That piece of unfunded liability from the 16-17 cycle will get amortized over 20 years from that valuation, the 17 valuation. Again, 20 years, level percent of payroll, and using our assumed rate at that time. So that will drive another piece of the unfunded actuarial liability employer contribution rate. So, in advance of this legislative session, Milliman refreshed a letter that they had produced previously explaining what the results or consequences are of extending the amortization period. So, Senator Johnson, finally to your question. 20 years has the shape of the green part of this graph. In other words, at 20 years on a level percent of payroll, your amortization gradually goes down until, of course, in 20 years it's paid off. If instead you extend the amortization to 25 years or to 30 years, there is a long period, a significant period of time, where you have what's called negative amortization. Your principal balance of your unfunded liability grows because you're not making the minimum payment, basically. So if you extended out your unfunded, your UAL amortization to 30 years, as you see, that's the hashed out portion of this graph, you're out 18 years before you even start reducing your principal balance. And in those intervening 18 years, changes in methods and assumptions and experience will add other slices to this unfunded liability. Now, Chair Taylor, you talked about how down the whole room is. If there was returns above assumption, if we had good years, then we would have reductions in those rates, and you could reduce the unfunded liability. Because Senator Johnson's already shaking her head.
Conversely, if, God forbid, the market crashed again, and I think inevitable market corrections occur in a business cycle, it would be catastrophic. I mean, we just accelerate the problem even more.
You absolutely, Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, you compound your problem because you haven't started filling the hole you're already in.
Yeah.
You're digging the hole even deeper, and then a whole bunch more comes out of it.
This would not be the session to give up drinking.
All right. But one could definitely start with this information. Senator Knope, were you going to say something? Okay. All right.
So now, just to quantify, just quickly, if I could, Chair Taylor.
Yes.
Sure. The Milliman's letter, this is all based on Milliman's letter, but your employer rate goes from 16.68% down to 13%. So you get a 3.5% reduction in your employer contribution rate if you go to 30-year amortization, but you have all the risks that we've just explored. And your repayments, instead of the total of those repayments being some $45 billion, the total of repayments over 30 years is $64 billion, so you're paying 43% more in total dollars over 30 years than you would in 20 years to pay it off over that time. So.
Pardon me, Mr. Woodman. Senator?
Just to tag on to what Senator Johnson just said, it would be, in my case, to start drinking.
That's right. That is true. That is true. We could make that happen for you, Mr. Hanselman, if needed. We don't want anyone to feel that their needs were not met. Yes, Senator Gosar.
I just wanted a clarification. When you're talking about payroll, does that mean, who does that mean? Is it just people that are currently working, or does it also include people who have retired out of the system?
Chair Taylor, Senator Gelser, thank you for the question. It is the PERS covered payroll, that is the pay being given to active members only. So we spread the cost of the system over active members for employer contributions.
With school board, special districts,
all of the
PERS employers.
Right.
Will get that 16% accelerating up to potentially 30.
If we were to do this.
Well, to be clear, the 16% is a component of the 30.
Okay, that's
correct. Yeah. Okay. We do want to make sure we have time for Senator Knope to discuss three additional ideas. Does anybody have any other questions for Mr. Rodman? Because we want to hear some more ideas. And this is perfect time if you have some great ideas to forward.
Well,
so thank you so much. And yes. So.
I did miss a portion of Mr. Shervam's presentation.
Yes.
So did somebody ask if he had a recommendation or a risk tolerance for the state to bond the unfunded liability or a portion thereof.
I think that's this. Yeah, it's her.
Okay.
I think it's her. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think if I understood, Lockwood McCall, Ms. Lockwood McCall. So, do you want, should we ask?
Yeah, again, for the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, I'm the director of debt management. So, John worries about risk tolerance in an investment portfolio.
Okay.
And I do whatever the legislature and the governor direct me to do, because my job is to implement your policies.
Mm-hmm.
The things that I talked about was we have sold $2 billion in pension bonds.
Right.
To manage previous unfunded liabilities.
Right.
So the real choice is we have debt capacity within the Constitution to do more, but the real choices are, do we want to use our debt capacity in general for the state? And I think that if we chose to say we want to do all the capital projects and we want to do this pensions, and well, our debt ratios will skyrocket. And they're already considered moderately high relative to other states. So that's really the decision, which was we may face getting downgraded from the rating agencies. And that may not matter relative to the theoretical saving of some dollars in terms of pension costs. But those are the choices we would be facing. So either we have to choose between infrastructure or bonding for pension obligations. If we choose to do both, our debt ratios will skyrocket and we will most likely be downgraded. As I mentioned earlier, State of Alaska was considering doing this and was facing down the barrel of downgrades. The governor was proposing to do it. The legislature pulled him back, and they chose not to do that.
Yes.
We also discussed the other risk factors, the timing of the sale and other variabilities. That left me with the impression that that is probably a less desirable option at this juncture.
And I would turn to John to say whether it's always best to sell at the bottom of a market when you sell these bonds. This is a side account that helps offset your rates. If you have to draw heavily in those side accounts because of the losses in the first few years, you'll never be able to make it up. And so it's not just as simple as the assumed rate versus my borrowing rate. There's also the corpus of that side account and whether it can generate enough resource to be have been worth it. The folks who sold pension obligation bonds in the local school districts in 07 are not going to break even. We have been doing better than break even. We sold in 03. I believe John said that we had just experienced about a 20-something plus percent drop in the market. And we are above water, even with the problems in 08 as a result.
Okay.
Okay, so do you want to go ahead and talk about your three different ideas from your work group?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. So as kind of part of recommendations that we've received, so beyond the bills that we talked about, the $100,000 final average salary and the five-year final average salary calculation from 3 to 5, and then of course redirecting member accounts, we talked about those on Monday. The other elements that were recommendations, and these aren't the extent of recommendations, but they are recommendations that were made by Milliman or made to the work group and us as legislators, and PERS agency did do calculations on those. So you can find these in the, I think, the summary of the Milliman report. So one of them was to change the multipliers to 1% and 1.2. So that's dropping them from where they currently are. And I'd have to look them up, but Steve could probably go like this and tell me. But it feels like that's like dropping them about a quarter point or so. Is that half a point?
Mr. Okay. Rudman.
Very good. So
why don't you just come up in case we have questions, please? Thank you.
Well, I could look this up.
But we have to follow the rules. We need to have everyone on the record. We can't.
Sure.
Just state your name and answer the question real quickly if you're able to
answer it, please. Steve Rudman, Executive Director of PERS. The current multipliers for Tier 1 and Tier 2 are 1.67 for General Service, 2 for Police and Fire. And for OPSERP, it's 1.5 for General Service, 1.8 for Police and Fire. So it would drop all those down to 1% for General Service, 1.2% for Police and Fire.
So that's a pretty significant drop.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So that was one recommendation. There was another recommendation to go to 0.25 and 0.3. Nobody is considering that option. So that clearly has been dropped from the mix. And then there's the change in money match interest rate, which I believe when this was calculated for the potential savings, it was 3.5% was the number that was used in terms of calculating that. And we currently pay the assumed rate on money match.
Correct.
When we're annuitizing money match. So 7.5 currently.
Correct.
Okay. And then the other two really are the same, and that is either eliminating sick leave and vacation payments, or what some people call spiking as it relates to the final average salary, or halving the sick leave and vacation payments, so cutting those in half as opposed to eliminating those. And so there's various rates of savings from each of those individual options, but we wanted to, I think, consider these options. We haven't turned them into legislative drafts at this point, but I think we should kind of go through the rating of all the other bills, that other concepts that we're looking at, as well as these, because I think we were going to try to do apples to apples comparisons on all the potential concepts, and that includes the concepts that people have emailed in. I don't know, Senator Johnson, if you've shared any of those with the committee staff, or I just gave them a bunch of mine that I received over, the first 2 months of this year, but I think
I've gotten ostensibly
more.
The same ones, but I need to review the file. Once the session started, I kind of, my attention got diverted to transportation stuff, so I need to review the file. But I'd like to, if I may, ask the chair a question. Under the ground rules that you proposed, is it necessary to actually have legislative concepts drafted by LC to vet the ideas, or could Mr. Rodman's shop give us a high-level analysis of these three elements that Senator Canope just laid out, absent going to the expense of doing legal drafting? And I just want to know what the rules are. If Mr. Rodman's shop could give us some thoughts on them, absent spending as much money as it costs to do drafts, that would be my preference. But I don't know what you want to do.
Okay, so thank you for bringing that up. So where we're at is at this point with all the deadlines and et cetera. So for these three concepts in particular, their ideas at this point, the Senate president is the person who needs to say yes to having them made into LCs, and he has agreed to do that. So when we receive the language, then that will happen. The only reason why we're going to go ahead and do that, it'll be as simple as they can possibly do it right now, and the reason being is because I've been working with Mr. Rodman and with LC and with LFO and with DAS, because DAS is part of this also because of the contracts, and so that's Katie Koba, because they are limited in what kind of analysis they can do. They can only work with the information that we give them. So in this case, because Milliman has done some work on the concepts from your work group, these will go pretty quickly because we already have a lot of the information. When we receive comments from the public, and one, for example, is we have an email that says something to the effect of just buy them all out, okay, like concepts like that. We are taking those concepts. We have Deborah here is compiling all of them, and we then are going to, we give them to the technical experts on the subject, but again, they're limited on what they can do. But we will have a hearing. They won't go through and have a whole LC drafted on a sentence such as buy them all out, but we will have the technical panel up here, and Deborah will say, we received these ideas from the public. What do you think of that, and would that work? And then in this example, Mr. Rodman would be able to say, buying them all out plus minuses what that means. So I appreciate, and we did look into, because we have these different ideas, and having them all created into bills, of course, could become, you know, quite a production and be limited in what value they would have in the bill format. These three are pretty ready to go because you've already had the analysis done.
So let me tell you what I think I heard. These three ideas will be drafted yes. into LC so that they can properly be vetted through our established process,
yes.
that it has to be reviewed on the four corners of the bill, what the words say versus just a concept. But this should go fairly quickly because these concepts have been already studied and at least partially analyzed by Milliman.
Well,
some of the others that may not be acceptable solutions, like just buy them all out, we will not go to the expense of drafting that, but we will provide a transparent, on the record
yes.
opportunity for the agency to comment on why just buy them all out probably has limited efficacy.
And or, but they may, or we may decide that they, this has spurred a conversation and we should look at, in this example, what does it mean to buy them out?
Yeah. I think that's great.
And yeah. so also, just to add to the understanding of the conversation about these LCs, and a bit of good luck, over the years, the last 3 or 4 years, I think I've had all three of those concepts drafted. And so they're not going to start from scratch. They're going to put a new number on it, perhaps, and maybe touch it up a bit and shoot them out. So it's not going to be the kind of money that it would normally take to do a PERS bill.
With a blank piece of paper.
Exactly, because yeah. a lot of PERS bills are 20, 30, 40, 70 pages long. And so in this case, they already have, let's just say, a library of ones that they've already done.
So this is actually a perfect segue, Senator Johnson, because I wanted to inform everybody of what's on the calendar for the next 2 weeks. As much fun as we've had of talking PERS nonstop in our committee, I want to thank all the committee members for taking this so seriously and Senator Johnson taking time out of her busy schedule to come and to listen to all of this. We are going to hear other bill concepts. Believe it or not, the Senate Workforce Committee has other work to do, too, shocking as that may be. And so we're going to, for the next 2 weeks, hear other bills. We're going to have a week from today. I forget what the date is that. Maybe it's the 20th? Yeah. The 22nd, the day we're going to hear pay equity is 22nd. A week from today is... a week from today, we're going to talk about pay equity. On Monday, we have several bills that we need to address coming at the governor's request, some things like that. And we'll be sending out the agenda, of course, to talk about what's on the calendar for the next 2 weeks. Then 3 weeks from now, we'll dive back into PERS. And one of the reasons we're doing this is to give the technical experts the time with the bills that we have and with the comments we received, or the ideas, I should say, we received from the public, so we can sort through them, give the technical experts the time that they need to analyze them and have some sort of coordinated fashion when we come back and report on them. So, but if anybody wants to speak up or say something, yes, Senator Johnson.
I'm going to miss you on Mondays and Wednesdays for the next 2 weeks, but I certainly thank you for your courtesy in letting me be fully participatory in these conversations.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Does anybody have any other questions for our speakers here today, our experts, Ms. Lockwood McCall, Mr. Shervam, or Mr. Rodman, before they leave. These really are the three people that are, if we want to talk about refinancing, these are the people we need to be talking with if this is something that our committee wants to consider for the rest of the legislature to consider. This is the time. So, okay. All right. Thank you so much. And so I think we went over what's coming up next. Did we do that, Deborah? We went over everything?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and close an informational hearing on PERS. Our next meeting is Monday, February 20th. As a reminder, any kind of bill concepts that people would like to bring forward on PERS is due on February 28th. February 28th is the date. And we're going to adjourn meeting on Senate Committee on Workforce.